Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. Today, I am joined by Tiff Armit. Tiff, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. I'm pretty excited.
I'm very excited. Now, folks probably have recognized your voice if they listen to some incomparable episodes, but tell the people a little bit about yourself.
I am an incomparable person here and there, and a little bit of this and that, and I also have a podcast with my husband called Top Four, and yeah, a woman about the internet, I guess.
living the life of the internet maven.
That's right.
I don't know what that means, but it sounded good.
My way at the top. That's all it's about.
That's how it works, right?
Yep.
It seems to have worked in this election, but let's not get political.
Oh.
All right. I had to bring it up just there, but we'll move on from there. Although this episode is interesting because it talks about some things that could be perceived politically, but we'll get there when we get there. So let's talk about Star Trek and your interest in Star Trek. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
I would have a long time ago. And by maybe not that long ago, probably 10 years ago, I would consider myself even a Trekkie a little bit. Because I watched all of the original series. I've watched all of Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched a lot of... when you leave it for 10 years, you forget. My brain is like now process things about like babies and that kind of... Yeah.
But they take up a lot of space.
Save room for Star Trek. come on. What's the other one? Bald dude.
Next Generation.
Thank you.
Captain Picard.
Yes. You're like, God, loser.
No, okay. Well, I also would have guessed Deep Space Nine because part of that, Sisko, the main character, is bald as well. So
yeah, never did Deep Space Nine, but, you know, did we really liked the original series in my household. My brother had a box set, and he would just have it on all the time. I think he probably has seen every episode like 30 times. So I've heard every episode at least 30 times and have seen them a whole bunch. So I'm pretty excited that on your random trek, we got an original episode. So
we did. We got an original series episode. Not only did we get an original series episode, we got the best, well, in many, many people's rankings, this is not only the best episode of the original series, but the best episode of Star Trek period. Star Trek.
That's intense.
And it is. It's the city on the edge of forever. And many people, I think I don't do a lot of research generally before these episodes because I'm lazy. But the city on the edge of forever, I felt like I needed to do a little research because it is such an iconic Star Trek episode. And I've seen it a million times. And when I told my wife, I was like, oh, Marisa, do you want to watch The City on the Edge of Forever with me? I have to watch it for the podcast. She said, didn't we just watch that? And I was like, well, we did, but we're watching it again. So I've seen this episode like a million times. That is not an exaggeration. All right, it's a slight exaggeration. But it was like number 68 on like the TV Guide did like the top 100 TV episodes. Not just Star Trek, not just science fiction, just the top 100 things that you could see on TV. Wow. And The City on the Edge of Forever was 68 on that list, which is not bad.
Yeah.
Considering this is a first season Star Trek, and
yeah,
possibly, and I was reading a little bit about this, Harlan Ellison, who was the writer, as a famous science fiction writer, and when Gene Roddenberry was looking to get people to write for Star Trek, and it was new, and the network wasn't so sure about it. He thought, well, I'll just get big-name science fiction writers to write episodes, and everyone will be happy. And so one of the first people he approached was Harlan Ellison. Harlan Ellison wrote this episode. This is the 28th episode of the first season, which seems odd if they approached him first. But the script went through something like 14 revisions, because Harlan Ellison wrote a script that was radically different than the one we watched, and that he was apparently not a person who liked to focus. He liked to procrastinate, so I feel his pain. But we can talk about that. I can nerd out about The City on the Edge of Forever, as I've been doing, and I will continue to do. But let me ask you your top four. See, it's a little tie-in with your... I'm a professional. Star Trek characters, if you can name them. Top four.
What? This wasn't in the prepping material.
I just come up with these things.
Oh my god, that's just not that's not right. There's so many reasons to like different
that's
characters.
That's true.
Yeah, you're just laughing because you know you have a list.
I hadn't thought about it myself either. So, I do have a list. I have everyone who's listened to this, and I'll talk, and then you, as you're thinking,
all right,
everyone who's listened to this podcast knows my favorite character is, Reg Barkley from TNG, who you probably don't even know.
Nope.
Cause he's a super minor character, and he's a weird pick, but that's
my
first
pick. I like him because he's crazy obscure.
I like him because people who are listening to this, who've listened to many episodes before are probably skipping over this because I've said this so many times. Well, A, he's played by the actor who played Hal and Matt Murdock on the A-Team, so what's not to like about that? B, he plays a character who is not as self-assured as the rest of Star Trek characters, so that appeals to me, because he feels like he's super smart, but he's socially awkward, and he is obsessed with the holodeck and all kinds of things. So I have many reasons, but I've given you time to think. Have you come up with anybody?
I mean, I really like Sulu because I like George Takei.
Mm-hmm.
I never know.
Takei? Is it Takei
or Takei? I don't know. He says it all the time. He used to be on Howard Stern constantly. And so we'd hear interviews with him all the time. And he's a really great person. He's a super great advocate for a lot of wonderful causes. And mm-hmm. I just kind of like him. So,
Sulu.
Yeah, so Sulu gets an up there. I really liked Janeway as a captain.
Yes.
She was amazing and especially empowering. So there's two.
Look, you're halfway there.
I know, right?
And you've beaten...
sexy first in command, second in command. Oh, what's his name?
Riker?
Yeah, with a beard.
Yep.
Yeah, he's hot.
All right. I had to guess. I don't want to.
I like him for his mind.
his bearded mind.
Yes, beardy mind. I'm not even that into beards at all, so I don't know why. I'm just kind of grabbing at people.
Hey,
this is getting crazy episode.
This
all right,
is.
Keep your hands to yourself, Tiv.
All right.
Here's a fake character.
That's okay. Right. No grabbing Riker.
Please don't.
Because
I can't think of another one, I'm going to say a Tribble.
Oh, Tribbles are so cute.
That's right. My number four character is a Tribble.
The thing I was thinking about is if The City on the Edge of Forever is the most iconic original series episode or the one that people would know, like people who aren't into Star Trek would know this episode, but I don't think that's true. I think it is The Trouble with Tribbles that most people would associate with Star Trek. So, bravo for picking a Tribble.
I also like Scotty too.
Scotty or a Tribble.
Yeah.
That's the,
I know. Yeah, it's a toss-up.
The choice.
And it's either skinny or fat Scotty. I don't care.
Oh, that's true. I like Scotty in all his forms.
Yep, exactly.
He's a very good character. I didn't particularly like what they did with him in Star Trek V, but once again, that's a super Star Trek nerd thing. though I did really like him when he was on The Next Generation. So hooray for
Worf
Scotty.
Worf is good too. I like Worf.
This is expanding. What do you think?
I know. I'm thinking of all the things.
What about Spock? You didn't mention Spock. How do you feel about Spock?
Spock is fine. He's all right.
Lukewarm yeah. Spock.
Yeah.
There.
Oh my goodness. Hold on. Yeah, lukewarm on Spock. The mute switch. Did you like that?
Oh, that was very professionally done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you mentioned Sulu, who plays a small but critical role in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
This episode mostly focuses on our holy trinity of McCoy, Spock, and Kirk. I noticed on your list of people that expanded beyond four after you thought that perhaps you could even come up with four, that Kirk, nowhere to be seen.
I do like Kirk as a captain very much. I think he is more of... he's kind of like a meme now instead of someone to take really seriously. You know, like with the bones, what do
yes.
you think? Right? Like that's...
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, I mean, what can you say about, name, actor,
William Shatner.
William Shatner. I mean, yeah. So what can you say about William Shatner now, which is hilarious, especially all of his albums.
It's true. He has turned into a caricature of himself, but I think he's okay with that. So
I did like him on that lawyer show. I'm super good at names tonight.
Denny Crane
Boston
on
Legal.
Boston Legal. There you go. The only reason I watch that show every once in a while because William Shatner was on it, and Brené Aubergeon, I don't think that's how it says his name, who played Odo on Deep Space Nine, also on that. So,
I liked it for James Spader.
James Spader, he's good. Mm-hmm. That's why I watched The Blacklist for as long as I did. And then I gave up on it.
You gave up?
I gave up. It's so ridiculous.
It's a parody of itself. It's amazing.
Here's my problem with The Blacklist, and also, which was my problem with Lost, which I gave up on as well, is because, so in The Blacklist, and maybe they resolve this and it's not a problem and I can go back, but the whole mystery about who's her father and is Red her father or not, and you're like, I don't know.
They didn't resolve that. Do you think they'd give that up? Come on, network TV.
That's what I assumed. That's why I was like, I am sick of you kind of promising, like, on the next all-new episode of The Blacklist, you're going to find out who the father is. And then you totally don't.
Yup.
NBC. Don't. But it was the first, I think I watched the first three seasons. Maybe there's not even three seasons. I watched a lot of The Blacklist, and I liked it very much, and then I kind of gave up on it. I watched less of Lost than I did of Blacklist, just because I thought Lost was even worse than The Blacklist at giving you, like, a little inkling and then two steps back.
We should probably talk about this episode because I have some like key jokes in here that I want to get in before we run out of time, know that we're out of time limit.
Well,
right?
Welcome to Random Blacklist, what we're going to be talking about. Or Random Spader. I think that would be a better.
I'd listen to that show.
See? Somebody who's listening, you can pick up on that.
All right, Scott, focus.
Focus, all right. I was going to then try to think if he'd ever been in any Star Trek, but I don't think he has. Christian Slater was, but that's another story. Okay, so City on the Edge of Forever. Super great episode. Spoiler alert. I think this is one of the best episodes of Star Trek ever. What do you think of this episode overall? And then we can just jump into what it is.
I really like this episode. I think it is kind of a... I think the props department went like awesomely crazy on this episode. And they're just like, oh my God, we get to use stuff that's not from space. Like, right? So they kind of went a little bit wild. And I think they had a good time. I especially love all like, you know, the random columns and stuff on the Strange Old Planet.
Oh,
but,
yes. I love when Spock is trying to do whatever it is he's supposed to do with his tricorder and like build a computer in their flop. Every time they go back there and they show Spock more and more, he's surrounded by more and more vacuum tubes.
Yeah, it just starts surrounding him like a little soldier. It's so funny. He like just built himself into a cage of vacuum tubes.
And then Joan Collins stops by and she's like, what's going on?
Don't worry, Joan Collins. Good episode. It was a good one, and it kind of took you out of the norm, I think, of a lot of the episodes. Mm-hmm. And brought you into this alternate world. And, you know, you got to have a little bit of fun mind tricks with the whole grandfather paradox situation of what's going on. And so I really liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. My wife, Marisa, had her main problem watching this was, and I only found this out yesterday when we were talking about it. She said, I wish they had cast someone other than Joan Collins as Edith Keeler. And I said, why? Joan Collins is like a giant star. She was a big get for them at the time. And she said, all I can think of is Dynasty when I see Joan Collins. And I was like, well, I think this is like 20 years before Dynasty, so I'm not sure that that could have impacted their casting. But Edith Keeler, my favorite line that is used, I think, several times in this episode is Edith Keeler must die.
Yep. Thanks, Spock. Thanks. We get the picture.
Poor Edith Keeler.
All right. So do we have to go in order or can I just jump in here?
We can just jump around because
I think I have. The question was kind of towards the end of the episode. So we're assuming that everyone's seen this episode. So yeah, we can
this episode, I think, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen The City on the Edge of Forever, pause this podcast. Go to any streaming or your Blu-ray player, whatever, and watch the episode, and then come back. All right.
So, big question. Edith Keeler must die, right?
Yes.
So, if Kirk loved her as much as he was like, I love her, right?
Very quickly,
as much as
he falls in love.
Why doesn't he decide to take her back to the ship, and therefore she would leave Earth, and it would be like she died, but she didn't? And so, like, the world would go on, and if he made that decision, that would change history, right? Like, technically?
Well, that's true. I mean, I guess that Spock there, I bet he would argue against that, because, you know, we don't know what would happen if you bring her back. And plus, I think also, and so my,
she's like all like, you know, space ready. We think, you know, you, when we meet her,
she is,
we think she's
going to
be all religious and mm-hmm. be, you know, talking to everybody. And it turns out she's really like a crazy space missionary, you know, like,
it is true. It's a good twist. Cause she stands up and all the, I don't know what the proper term is anymore. I was going to call them bums, hobos. Is that right? I don't know.
Men in need.
Oh, that's
homes.
Better. Down home on their luck. Yes. Fellows.
Down on their luck fellows.
Yeah. At the, what is it? 21st,
21st Street missionary.
Yes. Yep. Are, you know, got their soup and turn to Kirk and Spock, and they're like, oh, you thought this was going to be free? And then Edith Keeler gets up, and just like you said, we think, oh, she's going to, like, play a hymn or make everybody talk about whatever god she believes in. But nope, she's like, everybody should strive for the future, and when we're going to be one, and we'll be flying around in spaceships, and everyone will have food, and you're like, where is this coming from, Edith Keeler? It's kind of weird.
Exactly. So it seems like she would, you know, really do well up in space.
Well, I think
she'd be okay, but
that is a clever solution. However, I think the writers, you know, Harlan Ellison got the credit, but this thing was rewritten by like 8 other people, came up with a weird thing. Cause the Guardian, right, is this big donut that you jump through and gives you time travel. And I'm not quite sure about the designers of the Guardian, because you cannot tell it when you want to go. It just kind of...
And you can't even tell it how long, like, how to play history back. It only has one, like, speed.
Yep,
come
just
on, Guardian.
You can't tell it where to start. You can't tell it to stop. It just, I guess, is a loop. I don't know. And it seems to know that they are... Well, there's a Vulcan there, but they're mostly human. So I guess the Guardian just assumes they want Earth history and not Vulcan history. I have many questions about the Guardian. But
Guardian's still in beta. That's
left true. It there. And he so McCoy jumps through, right, because he's shot himself full of this cortisine or whatever the heck it's called. And he's gone crazy. He's loco. He thinks everyone's gonna kill him. And so he beams down to this planet and he jumps through the Guardian and goes back in time. And so our friend Spock and Kirk have to find him because, you know, there are two things here, right? He changes history, so the Enterprise is gone. And also, he's their friend, so they want to save the friend. And so they jump through. But the Guardian tells them, you know, you will come back when you fix history. So I guess they really can't, like, call up the Guardian and say, listen, let's get Edith Keeler out of here.
So that was one line of dialogue that I kind of, like, just missed. Right, that like explained away how they got home.
Exactly, because you're like, well, okay. how are they going to get back? And apparently the Guardian knows when time has been fixed, and so it can bring it back.
Yeah. God forbid the Guardian pauses history for a second so we can find out where Bones went. But
nope, you've got to hope that Spock was recording with his tricorder.
Let's go back there, fix your mess, and then I'll bring you home.
And then he'll know. Yes, he can't start and stop time, his time replay, but he can know when... you have changed history back to the way it's supposed to be.
Did they get rechanged out of their history clothes when they got back?
Oh, I think they did. I don't think they...
They like jumped through the Guardian.
And
like,
they're wearing their uniforms.
Yeah. Yep.
I didn't notice that, but that's true.
Oh, man. I was missing, you know, Spock's dad jeans that he found. And
and his hipster hat.
Kirk became like a lumberjack hipster.
Yes.
Right?
He's ready. He could have been in Portland in right now.
Exactly. A little more beard. And he's good to go.
That's right. I do enjoy... I mean, this episode is a strange... strange tonally, because there's a lot of funny, wacky music that's playing and funny things happen, but then it's at the heart of it, it's this tragic story about how Kirk falls in love with Edith Keeler super quickly and then is forced to watch her die, basically. Not even just watch her die, but let her die. Actively stop McCoy from saving her, which makes it even worse, right? I'm always a little... question how Kirk falls in love with Edith Keeler so quickly. I mean, she's super nice. She's like a saint. She's helping everybody. She's all up into space. And Kirk, of course, is not super discerning, so he kind of falls in love with everybody.
I know. I was like, why are you questioning this? He's like, he's in love with every woman he meets. Yeah,
that's true. And Joan Collins is very attractive, so I guess it all checks out. I take it back. but why does she fall in love with him so quickly is the question.
Well, he's a lumbersexual, isn't he? Like, he's super. He's got the look. I mean, he's ready to go.
He is, and he's willing to work hard 10 hours a day for 12 cents an hour or something like that.
No, he gives her some serious dreamy eyes, like, right away.
He does. Bam. Mm-hmm. And I noticed
I'm looking at you, Edith.
And she has a name. Edith is not the greatest name. No offense to anyone listening whose name is Edith, but...
I like Edith. Yeah, I do.
It's kind of a throwback name. And whenever I think of Edith, I think of two things, both television, either Edith Keeler or Edith from All in the Family. And I liked her a lot, so I guess I'm okay with Edith. I'm back on board with the Edith name. I changed my mind.
But okay, so Edith's love interest in Kirk anyway, right? So she finds them in a basement, admit to stealing. And then she gives them a job. And then she's like, oh, and then she finds them stealing again, like breaking into the... for the tools so mm-hmm. that Spock can build his computer.
Vacuum tube computer.
Yeah, vacuum tube microfiche looker. Like, that's what it pretty much looks like, right? Yeah, just looking through news articles at some point. And, but yeah, so she like walks in the basement, sees them stealing, and then all of a sudden they're like, she's like, you know what? You're super sketchy. It's cool. But by the way, can you walk me home? Like, she's just... Like, who trusts these people? What is wrong with her?
She has she has a big heart and she wants to help people. It is very strange that, yeah, she finds them in her, cowering in her basement, and she's like, hey, you guys need a job.
Yeah, that's the first one. And then they're like being super creepers next to the furnace. And,
oh, yes.
Right? And like mm-hmm. Kirk's like leaning against the wall and like being really kind of just awkward and sketchy mm-hmm. down there. And she's accusing them of stealing, and then she's like, oh, well, all right, I guess I trust you, even though you just stole some stuff, so walk me home. Thanks.
That's cool. And then she's like, why does he call you captain? And he's like, oh, it's a long story, I can't tell you.
Oh, yeah, that's a good line when she's like, even when he doesn't say mm-hmm. it, he does.
Yes.
Edith, you're so perceptive.
She's a perceptive gal, but very trusting, which is what we find, and a pacifist. So we mm-hmm. find out that if Edith Keeler does not die... She meets the president, convinces him that the war is not the answer and delays the U.S.'s entrance into World War II, and which means that the Nazis win the war, which is bad news for everybody, and means that the Enterprise will no longer exist. So they got to fix that. They have to stop that, and the only way to stop it, well, is to kill Edith Keeler. But they can't just kill her, because that would be creepy and a different kind of show. They need to figure out how she dies and what Bones has done to change the course of how she dies.
Yeah, Spock has a long conversation with Kirk about letting her fall down the stairs at some point. And I'm like, man, you guys are brutal.
Spock is very logical. He has a problem. He knows the solution. Yeah, that's a good scene where she is standing on the stairs with Kirk and she slips and falls. And Spock gives him that look about, Kirk catches her. And Spock is like... How did you know that wasn't when she was supposed to die? Kirk's like, dude, she's my girlfriend.
I know. Give me like 10 seconds with her. My goodness.
You and your rice picker ears. That is one of my favorite parts when Kirk tries to explain to the police officer what has happened and what they're trying to do.
Yeah, when they get caught stealing clothes mm-hmm. because they feel awkward in their uniforms out in public.
In their pajamas. Looking at them. That's yep. what they are. And yeah, there are a lot of people on that street, and they're all mm-hmm. looking at him. And that happens again when they try to run away from the police officer. And he has to give this ridiculous story about missionaries, and he fell into a rice picker, there was a plastic surgeon. And the police officer clearly does not believe any of it and just tries to... what do? They arrest you. That's what police officers do. Yes. Not always. They're policing the community, but that's what he was going to do.
He started the whole pat-down procedure, yes. and then Spock kind of turned around and did his little like sleeper hold. Yep.
And off they went with the clothes. They ran away.
Yep. Which he tried earlier on Bones after they did a terrible job of trying to like find him sneaking around this like 10-foot area.
let us talk about that for a moment. Their search for Bones on the planet is not well done. He crouches.
No, it is not a thorough search at all. Like, they just like kind of casually walk past and they're like, oh, no sense looking behind here. See if he's hiding.
We don't need to look behind this giant rock. McCoy could not fit behind there, or this wall,
or this Doric column. Like, that's right.
We just look around, and they have tricorders too. So why didn't they just use their tricorders and find him? There are a lot of questions about this.
Yeah, isn't that like find my phone? Like you could have just done that
exactly.
Like, just and bring him up.
He would have beeped, and they could have just found him. But no,
he's all rabid and crazy.
He is
trying to get away from everybody.
And apparently not the greatest doctor, because he was holding that hypo spray very poorly, I think, especially when it's set to this super dangerous drug that then he injects all of into his stomach.
Or maybe he's just trying to protect everybody else. And he was like, well, if it was going to be somebody, it's going to be me.
Oh, that's a good way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Kudos to you, Bones.
But I guess he could have just held it towards the floor.
Well, that's true. Or just dropped it.
For everybody.
But he doesn't do that. It's a split moment decision making.
No, but then we wouldn't get rabid bones, so that's fine.
That's true. And he does get when we see him later, so that you, like we said, you can't tell the Guardian where you want to go in time, because I don't know, it's less fun that way. So they guess, and I guess they show up. It's unclear to me how much in advance they show up to Bones, but we'll say a week, maybe a couple days. I don't know.
Well, I think they might have said it at some point. I can't remember though, because Spock was building his computer thing for a while.
He was.
And he was saying like, "Oh, this it took us this long to get this much money." So I think
there's
a way to figure out how long it took them, but.
And he did mention that it took him, like, there was 30 hours work that was blown the first time he used his computer. Mm-hmm. So. I'm sure someone
on
the
30
internet.
Hours on top of his regular job, which he's using to make the money.
Which is his 10 cents an hour. And there is a funny scene where Kirk comes in and he's like, "Hey, how's it going?" And he's like, "Oh, great. I just need a small block of platinum, maybe 4 or 5 pounds, and everything will be great."
Yeah. And Kirk's like, "Not going to happen.
I have some vegetables.
I can offer you this baguette."
Which looks pretty good. I'd like to take a moment to thank Casper for sponsoring Random Trek. Now, you friends, you've heard me talk about Casper before. It is the internet mattress company that sends you a normal-sized mattress in a tiny box, and it's shipped right to your door. They also offer an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. They have an in-house team of engineers that spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Maybe that's the mattress that Edith Keeler put Dr. McCoy on. That's her secret. That's why she can keep people in her secret room, because she has a mattress from Casper. Mattresses can cost over $1,500 often, but Casper mattresses cost $500 for twin-size mattress, $600 for twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, and $950 for a king. Now, buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. I know you're a little reticent to order a mattress on the internet, but don't worry. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up, refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially since you'll be spending a third of your life on it. I'm trying to up that for myself personally, because I like to sleep. Now, you get free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. It's made in America. Now, of course, we have a special offer just for Random Trek listeners. You get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/trek and using the offer code Trek. That's T-R-E-K. Casper.com/Trek. Now, terms and conditions apply. Thanks to Casper for sponsoring Random Trek. Bones, he comes in whenever he does later, and he looks super messed up. He looks crazy. He's raving.
He's polka dots.
He is polka dots.
He's crazy polka dotted Bones.
he looks not so good. Nope. And you think, if I saw that man on the street, I would not approach him. But someone does approach him. Another man down on his luck, whose name
who we know from the mission earlier.
Yes, who may have been the same guy who told people that the meal is not free. You have to listen to good old Edith Keeler and her crazy future talk. And his name apparently is Rodent. I don't know if that's ever said in the episode, but it's a great name. And he has a little back and forth with McCoy, and then McCoy passes out.
And he has some sort of like fever dream about, you know, past surgery. You know, he's getting all upset about needles and stitches. And
and Rodan's like, "Whoa, dude."
He's like, "Oh my God, it's so barbaric." And then he just passes out.
I was just trying to steal milk and you came like upon
you're
me.
You're a terrible doctor. A little, you know, thought of some blood and some needles gonna make you sick.
Oh, no. It's like Doc Martin on the BBC, if anyone watches that. I don't even actually know if it's on the BBC. It's a British show. I assume every British show is on the BBC. Check it out if you haven't.
So this man, what was his name? Rodent?
Rodent, yes. He does
He steals. What does he steal from Bones?
He takes Bones' phaser.
And so he pretty much disintegrates himself?
He kills himself, basically, yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like, what? He just kind of disappeared. I'm like, what just happened?
Yeah, that wasn't super clear, because it doesn't... It is not the traditional phaser look. Like, it doesn't have a handle. It's just the little top part. And he presses a button, and he kills himself. Not great.
Wow, it's that
for
easy?
For Roland, apparently. That's what I was thinking. You'd think there'd be, like, a safety... Like
keep the safety on that, especially when you're crazy. It's like the suicide boots from Futurama, right?
Yes. So Rodent, sadly, not long for this world. And then Bones, I forget how Bones ends up. Does Edith Keeler come across him?
He stumbles into the mission because he sees a whole bunch of people outside. And then he's looking all crazy while she's pouring coffee for people. And she's like, oh, you look insane. And
I love insane people.
I know. Let me take you to this back room where there's a cot and you could lay down. And they pass each other, like, and Spock comes out to start, I guess, his shift at the mission, and just misses seeing Bones.
And you think
Edith
Spock
takes him away?
Look up.
Yeah, exactly. And then Edith keeps him in this back room for, like, I don't know, a week. Like, how long is he back there?
It doesn't he's back seem there for like a long time.
Been allowed to leave? Like, just kind of stands there waiting for her.
Well, he's a little crazy though, but she does nurse him back to health though. That's the good thing. Edith Keeler. She's good at what she does. Too good. And that's why she must die. Oh, poor Edith Keeler. I know. I read an article about this where they were complaining because they think that this episode teaches you the wrong lesson and that it rails against pacifism, which is what we should be achieving, going for. And it brings up the tired trope of trying to kill Hitler. If you could time travel, would you travel back in time and kill baby Hitler or not?
It became a trope, but was it then? Or was it still interesting then?
That was what I was thinking as I was reading this article, because this episode is, you know, it was aired on TV 50 years ago, so I feel like maybe it was not.
TV was kind of like, you know, new-ish, right?
Exactly.
Like, it didn't have time to get tired.
And plus, I think that, you know, who, if you know, now, I Edith Keeler is a lovely person, but if you know that if she does not die as she's supposed to, that millions of people will die because the Nazis win World War II, I think the moral imperative is to make sure that Edith Keeler does in fact die.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
See, that's what Spock, that's why Spock just wants to kill her immediately.
He was ready to go.
He's like, oh, let me at her, Captain. She will not beat me in a fight. this is where they huddle around the tricorder, right, and read, put in some microfiche and read some old newspapers. And it's weird, though, right? Because...
Well, they were trying to figure out if Edith... Because they weren't sure for a lot of the episode if Edith needed to stay alive or to die.
Right, they didn't know what the right answer was.
Yeah, they weren't sure because they saw two different alternate futures and they weren't sure which one got them back to their ship.
So yeah, because Spock saw, like, briefly the first time he saw her obituary, that was her first obituary, and then, which is unclear as to why he saw that. Oh, I guess because he was recording it from the Guardian was playing in his little newsreel of history.
is that how that got there?
I think so. I think that's what
sense.
They were.
Okay.
And one of my questions in my research, as I was watching this, I was like, oh, I guess history is in black and white because The Guardian plays back every historical event in black and white. It turns out black and white stock footage, much cheaper than color stock footage. And that's why they went with black and white stock footage. And I thought, who knew? I learned something today.
The Guardian's a cheap bastard, let me tell you.
It doesn't even have effective controls. Can't afford color stock footage of Romans and Nazis. So I think that's what Spock recorded it with his tricorder, and they were trying to figure out. And so he was recording it a little bit before McCoy jumped in. After McCoy jumped in, they restarted the loop, I guess, with the Guardian, and he recorded it all, and so things had changed. So I guess that's why that is like that.
All right, sure. Yeah, one line of dialogue explains it away. It's fine.
It's fine. And then, yeah, so they figure out, Edith Keeler must die. But then they don't know when or how she dies. But then Spock says, well, I think she dies in this car accident, so we'll need to make that happen. Although it seems like a surprise when it does, in fact, happen.
Yep.
And nobody knows. So it's weird, because science fiction, so Star Trek is of its time, and it's telling, and science fiction in general is of its time, so it's telling a story about the future, but it's really a commentary on the present. And so you get all the Star Trek characters seem to know an awful lot about 20th and early 21st century history of Earth.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, yes, I remember this, learning about this in my history class.
But they don't remember, they don't know who Clark Cable is. And they're like, I don't know who that is, because Edith Keeler really wants to go to a movie.
She's like, there was something else, too, that was really simple that they were like, what? I don't know. Hold on. You can cut that out, right?
Yes.
Okay. Spock doesn't understand cars. Like, when they first get there, he's like walking across the street, and Kirk's like, keep moving, man. Like, and Spock's like, what is happening? So,
what are these strange vehicles?
Everything else is fine, but cars, that was
the
weird one.
They freak him out. And that's that reminded me of Star Trek IV, where they have a very similar scene where the crew is traveled back in time again, but this time to the 80s in San Francisco, and they're crossing the street, and Kirk almost gets hit by a cab. And then the famous Star Trek line where the cab driver yells out, hey, dumbass, get a move on it. And of course, Kirk responds, double dumbass on you, which because profanity, they don't swear in the future. That's what we've learned. Unless it's Battlestar Galactica, then they're swearing all the time. But that's a different future. And so we find out, and then there's a series of kind of actually, there's only that one near miss because of McCoy. Because, you know, Spock and Kirk are trying to find McCoy. They don't really have a great plan for finding McCoy. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like, let's hang out in this city and hope that he shows up in the same place that we do.
Well, I guess once they figure out about Edith, they figured that he interacted with her in some way.
I guess so that makes sense.
If they keep hanging around with Edith, then he's going to show up. Into him. And that's what happens, pretty much. She brings him up in conversations, and she was keeping him in a back room, like, you know.
I forget how that comes up. She was like, oh, you're just like McCoy. And they're like, McCoy? Leonard McCoy?
McCoy? You mean my prisoner?
Yes, I'm just keeping him back there for freshness. But then they're off to see the movie, because Edith Keeler really wants to go to a movie with Captain Kirk. Who can blame her?
Yep.
And that's when Spock and Kirk and Edith Keeler all leave the mission together, because I guess Spock is going to go on a walk or something. I don't know. I think Kirk and Edith leave, and then Spock wants to get their attention. So Kirk is like, they cross the street. This is important. And then Kirk says to Edith Keeler, stay right here. Do not move. And she's like, okay, whatever, Jim. And then off to... Jim talks to Spock, and then there's this moment where McCoy comes out, and everybody is really happy because it's McCoy, and they all hug each other.
And then unite.
That's right. Reunite. And they're all like, hooray! And then Edith Keeler's like, what's all this business? So she crosses the street. She does not look both ways.
No.
Because she gets hit by a truck. And McCoy sees this happening, and he can see what's going to happen. So he wants to run after her and save her, which is what he does, one assumes, before Spock and Kirk jump in to the Guardian and change history forever. And so Kirk has to restrain McCoy so that he will not go save his girlfriend. McCoy, she dies. And McCoy says, don't you understand what you did, Jim? I could have saved her. And that's when we cut to a close shot of Spock saying, he knows exactly what he did. Very dramatic.
It is.
And it's kind of a touching moment, though.
It is. I like that moment. It was really good. And then all of a sudden, they magically come back through the Guardian, and then the great and powerful Oz announces that time has been restored, and the crew that was left on the planet is like, oh, you've been gone for like 2 seconds. What happened? Did anything happen? And they're like, we've been gone for weeks.
Yeah, you don't understand, man. We've been going back to 30s.
Yeah. And then it's the final line was like, let's get the hell out of here.
That's right. Captain Kirk is like, let's get the hell out of here. Which, in my research, I found that NBC, the censors at NBC, or whatever they call them, standards and practices, I think, because censors doesn't sound so nice, did not want the word hell to be used. And Gene Roddenberry had to fight to keep that line in because he thought that
it actually aired with hell, huh?
It did, yes.
Wow.
He fought innovative. It because he was like, that is the best word to describe what has happened to Captain Kirk, and we're keeping it. Darn it. And the censors were like, okay, whatever. No one's going to watch this crazy show anyway.
There was also no star date for this episode.
That's right. It's a non-star dated. And it doesn't open with a captain's log, right? So, because it opens with... Oh, no, it does. But he doesn't tell us what... Or does he? I don't know.
It opens in like a different star... A different... And then later on...
Oh, it does not open with a captain's log. But they're hovering around.
He starts a captain's log again and he says, no star
date. Because he doesn't know what date it is.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yes. So this is... Now we can... I'll quickly... tell you a little bit about what the original. So Harlan Ellison, who people who are listening may not be aware of who Harlan Ellison is. He's a science fiction author. He's one of the greats. He's also known as a bit of a prickly pear, that Harlan Ellison. He has opinions, and he does not like it when other people have differing opinions about his work or what have you. So the first, he wrote this episode. Mm-hmm. It was quite different when he wrote it, though, because it was about... there's this guy named Beckwith, who was a crew member on the Enterprise, who also happened to be a drug dealer on the Enterprise, and he was selling drugs on the Enterprise. He was selling a drug called the Jewels of Sound, and he got another crew member addicted to it, and the crew member who was addicted thought, okay, I have to break this addiction, so I'm going to tell Key. He confronted Beckwith and said, I'm going to tell the captain about this. And Beckwith does what anyone would do and bludgeons him to death. And
of course.
Yes, that's what you do. And then Beckwith is found, one assumes, covered in blood. And he's court-martialed, as you do. And his sentence is that they are to beam down to a desolate, uninhabited planet and kill him with a firing squad. So this Whoa. All sounds like normal Star Trek, right? Now, I will say in Harlan Ellison's defense that he was one of the first people to write a script for Star Trek. And so he had not seen any episodes of Star Trek because he was writing it before there were episodes of Star Trek. So he didn't quite know that people did not get court-martialed and shot at in firing lines. And then they beam down to the planet and they actually meet in his script. The Guardians were actually people. Who were guarding this time portal.
That makes more sense.
It does. And he jumps through and changes a bunch of stuff, and they go find him. And in the story, actually, he jumps through, and the Enterprise is still there, but it's turned into like a pirate ship. They're like space pirates. And then there's a whole kind of B-plot on the space pirate ship, and Kirk and Spock go run after him. And then they find him. And this is my favorite part. They bring him back, and the Guardians sentence him to death, because that's the way it is. But their sentence is that they are going to put him in the center of a star and let him get killed over and over again for the rest of time.
Pretty sure that's not how that works.
Well, but... the Guardians apparently can do this because they can control time. The folks at Star Trek were like, this is really well written, but kind of not Star Trek.
Yeah, I think I like this version better.
Yes, and Harlan Ellison, though, was super mad for 50 years about what they did. And I think he's still alive, so he's probably still very mad about what they did to his script.
Ruined.
He's a man with integrity, I suppose, artistic integrity at the very least. But yeah, this episode, I think I would say it started all the kind of time travel shenanigans, but the first season of the original series had other time travel shenanigans as well. So I think that's always been a part of Star Trek DNA, of traveling around and fiddling with history.
Screwing
everything up, yep. Now, this episode, sadly, did not have much Scotty, Sulu, or Uhura.
No, Uhura has some dumb lines.
Oh, she has really bad lines.
Yeah, right after Bones goes through the Guardian and she's like, I'm so scared. But yet she looks like a rock. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, why did she have to say that? Because she looks crazy awesome right now. And you had to give her that, like, dumb, vulnerable line. I was kind of mad.
Yeah, and she's the only woman, so I guess she had to express the fear for everyone because all the men could not be afraid, even though they would be terrified because they are literally out of time, and the ship that they were hoping would take them away no longer exists. So everybody there should be scared, I think. You know, whenever I watch an original series episode, I'm reminded that things were very different 50 years ago.
Yes.
So they give Uhura these crappy lines, although having her there was very progressive, so thumbs up for that. But then also, and it's always funny, like Joan Collins is a beautiful woman, and every time they show her on a shot that's just her, and I think they did this with every woman on Star Trek, they have like that Vaseline kind of soft focus thing. And you're like, really? Why? And then it switches back to Kirk or whoever, and perfect focus.
You cannot gaze upon the woman with, you know, clear eyes. Otherwise, you don't know what to do with yourself, and you'll just go crazy, right?
Like, that's right, like McCoy.
Men can't handle it. They'll just go bonkers.
They'll go crazy. And DeForest Kelly, another fun fact, DeForest Kelly apparently thought that it would be good if he also fell in love with Edith Keeler.
Yes, he did. He was like, he had Stockholm syndrome, though, because he was, you know, kind of abducted.
It's true. He was put into a closet.
He's like, I love you. Just let me out.
I wonder how many of those men she just has trapped in there and they just can't leave. And she forces them all to listen to her soliloquies about rocket ships in the future. And they're all like, if you keep the coffee and soup coming, I'll stay.
See, this is a whole other side of Edith. But she could have her own series of, like, just abducting homeless men. Homeless, diseased, confused men, just putting them into her back room.
That's right. And bringing them back to health, but then making them listen to her crazy ideas.
And then they all love her. Like,
that's right. Her legion of
zombies.
Love.
Yeah.
And then do my bidding. Although Edith Keeler, so what did you think of Edith Keeler as a character? She seems a little one note.
I liked that I actually gave a woman some scientific ideas and interests, even though she was kind of set in the 30s. She was an independent woman.
Yes.
For the most part. You know what I mean? Like, she wasn't just like the wife or the girlfriend of somebody else until Kirk comes around, of course.
Well, Kirk. You can't resist.
I mean, it had to be done, right? So that was really great. And like, so I liked her. I did. I liked her. I just didn't like how trusting she was of these, you know, criminals.
Well, and that's part of her character, I think, that she's so pure and trusting. It didn't even enter her mind that though
she starts the peace movement. So
yeah, that's right. You know, she apparently is like, let's not get into a fight with the Nazis.
That's right. Everyone gets a second chance.
That's right. Which kind of paints Edith in a bad light, because you're like, we know Nazis not so good, so you should fight them. But in spirit, I agree with her that, you know, war is bad and it should be avoided at all costs. That's my controversial statement for today.
Yeah, I'm like, careful. We're about to get some serious political right now.
That's right.
Anyway, focus.
Yes. And I do agree with you that I think because, you know, Edith, she, one assumes, founded this mission. We don't, like, she doesn't have, like, her father or somebody you would think kind of traditionally would be like the guy who's founded the mission and she's just running it. And there would be scenes with her being told what to do or something like that. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of that. She's in charge. She's running the place. She tells people what to do. She pays them 10 cents an hour to throw stuff in the furnace.
She has her own place and she, you know, can recommend out, you know, places for other people to live.
Oh, right. That's right. Because other people come to her for finding homeless people to do work for them. Because, she bursts in one to Kirk and Spock and says, hey, if you guys can leave right now, I got a job for you. And that's when she finds out they're building these vacuum tube computers.
Yeah, and she's just like, what's that? And they explain it to her and she's like, cool.
she doesn't care one whit.
And that's when Kirk fell in love. It was that moment.
She's perfect.
I must add her to my collection.
Ooh. Everybody is kind of a sociopath in this episode.
Well, if you let me speak for everybody, I can turn everyone creepy pretty fast.
So do you think that this episode has earned its place as in the pantheon of Star Trek episodes as certainly, I think, universally hailed as the best original series episode, and more generally, I think, held up as the best Star Trek episode, period?
Well, I mean, it's a little hard to say because it is not as Star Trek-y as some other episodes. Just True. Like you said, you know, we miss a lot of the other characters mm-hmm. during this. It's mainly focused on the trifecta of friends that we see. So, I mean, like, but it does stand out, right? Like, it is different than a lot of other things. So it's a really easy one to remember. And it puts you into a place that a lot of people already know, kind of Earth and history mm-hmm. and cars. And, you know, they in that situation that it feels familiar. So it's a little bit easier to watch, I think, for someone who might not be a fan of Star Trek. So maybe that's why it kind of got bumped up into the likability.
That's good. And I think it is all leading up to that culminating scene of Edith Keeler dying. And I think, man, that's a great scene, and it is worth the journey of not because she's dead, but because mm-hmm. of the, you know, you can see it through, you know, I don't think anyone has ever accused William Shatner of being a subtle actor, so you can you can see his anguish mm-hmm. and you certainly could see McCoy's kind of outrage, and then Spock his lack of emotion. It's all just works so well.
Yep.
And
you
really
see them in plain clothes and kind mm-hmm. of like trying to fit in, and it creates a different dynamic. It takes away the kind of it's not so military ranking system as it is on the ship, like, oh, this person's listening to this person, that person's listening to this person, you know, so it kind of breaks that down, that hierarchy. And it's you get to see the characters more as people,
yes.
that are like everyday people. So I think, again, that is another way that it appeals to a larger audience, and therefore would, you know, get bumped up in the ratings and memories of people. So
that's true. And this episode is really tight. They have a lot of things to get through, so it just keeps moving, which I appreciate. Well, I also appreciate you, Tiff, joining me to talk about The City on the Edge of Forever. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really fun. Thanks.